I got an email from Graham this week. He said, just a little heads up, it's Earth Day on Sunday. Yes, that is correct, and thank you. Welcome to Earth Day. One of the things he mentioned in that email was that in the Wolseley area, there's all kinds of stuff going on, as you can imagine. And I hope I didn't sound like that was meant to be facetious in any way. That wasn't my intent. But it kind of fits the neighborhood, doesn't it? Anyway, one of the things that is happening under the kind of motivation of that community is something called a consumption Sabbath. The word Sabbath we've talked about before, the word Sabbath at its simplest just means stop. And so it's a consumption stoppage Sunday. That's a great idea. And once I was kind of thinking about it, then all of a sudden, you know, the way that our brains work, all of a sudden there were ads everywhere. Especially in the CBC world that I inhabit when I'm in my car. It was interesting that the main ad that I was hearing in that environment for Earth Day was mostly taken up with encouraging people to bring things down to be recycled, and in particular, sort of some of the big heavies that are a little harder to recycle, things like motor oil and tires and batteries and that sort of thing. And all of that got me thinking about recycling as it relates to lots of different things. And so some of what we're going to explore this morning, and I think it's fairly natural as we'll sort of see as we go, some of what we're going to explore this morning translates more directly into political thought than is usually the case for me as a teaching pastor. And I want to say simply that, as we always attempt to do here, the perspective that I want to represent is intended to be one that's a catalyst for dialogue, not an indoctrination about the perspective I'll bring. So that's sort of always where I'm coming from as a teacher. One of my friends, somebody I worked with for a number of years, used to say that he regarded his role as a teacher in the community of faith to just sort of stand up at the front and lob a grenade into the middle of the community and then go home. Maybe it's a little too violent an image, but catalyst is the point, not last word. Had an interesting experience a week or so ago that reminded me that the motivation behind recycling in our culture is often recognizably monetary. It was in a rural setting, standing around this huge pit dug in the middle of the ground, probably at least a third of the size of this space, full of garbage, and sort of part of a functioning farmyard, and it had been for decades. When you had stuff that was burnable, you dumped it in that pit, and you burned it. Pretty efficient way of dealing with certain kinds of waste in that setting. And it was full of junk, and some of it, we were actually standing, my friend and I were actually standing there having a conversation about how ugly it was, and how there were other ways to deal with the things that were in that pit, and how something needed to change. So we're just having this really intriguing conversation about all this stuff. And then this huge turbocharged diesel pickup pulls up, and it's somebody else that's sort of part of this big operation, and he hops out and goes around to the back of the truck and starts chucking stuff into the pit, right? Just like all this garbage. And then he gets out this can of something flammable, a bunch of matches, and he starts it on fire. Well, this is the way it's been done. So he's just doing what's been done. And then he reaches back into the back of the pickup and he pulls out the cooler. Starts passing around the beer. Then another guy from the neighborhood shows up, and first thing you know, I'm standing there with like three or four guys. We're standing around a pit of flaming refuse, drinking beer. And it's just drifting toward redneck, you know? And, okay, maybe we were there. No, there's a ways to go yet. Just wait. And so then the conversation turns to what to do with the empties. There's a whole kind of culture in this area that we're in that I'm unaware of that has to do with returning your empties and getting paid for them. And so then this kind of devolves rapidly into the conversation about whether it makes more sense to buy cans or bottles when you're buying beer in bulk, depending on the monetary return when you bring the empties back. And then that kind of went on to stories about who'd brought back the most empties. And by then the beer was gone, and what happened next I understood was a ritual that I wasn't aware of, but I kind of went in Rome, you know. So what you did with the empties when you're standing around a pile of burning refuse is you threw them into the fire and watched the paint peel. It's hard to find things to do in the country. Slow Sunday afternoons. It's a curious perspective about what was going on in that story, for me, because I was thinking about these things already, and I'm kind of watching this unfold and kind of wondering what I'm doing there, and there's this perspective that was going on inside of the conversation that suggests that we should recycle or we should care for the earth because of the economics of consumption. And it was made all the more curious to me in this instance because all the people but myself standing around that fire were part of the agriculture industry. It's implicit in the perspective that we should recycle because it's good economics that we would dial down our consumption in order to rein it in a bit, in order to kind of curb our overweening enthusiasm and valuing of stuff. If we wanted to put it another way, we should have a consumption Sabbath because we place too high a value on stuff. What I want to suggest this morning, though, is maybe the problem runs in the other direction. I want to suggest that there might be some merit to considering that we have some of the problems we do as a culture because we value stuff not too much, but actually too little. My older kids were recently getting a bit of kind of basic financial training. They were watching a video series by this financial guru, a guy named Dave Ramsey, over-the-top presenter, but just kind of good sound, basic stuff, geared to a younger audience. And he made a very interesting assumption in some of this material, which is that everyone, given the opportunity and the appropriate age, would own a car. And Tillman and I were actually having a conversation about this on the drive-in this morning, because he had spent some time in the U.S., and one of the families that was part of that experience, he said, how many cars do you think they had? I said, how many people were there? And the number roughly matched. You just have a car. That's the culture we're in. And we live in a world that is scaled to the automobile. And this despite the fact that the automobile hasn't been around for very long and actually has a foreseeable lifespan. It's not that bizarre to try to imagine a world in which we have infrastructure we can't afford to use from a number of perspectives. But that's how we're scaled. And there's a curious reality of a car culture that spills over into other realms. And that is that somehow we can find ourselves in a place where having a car isn't enough. And then we start to use need language for another car. And then we start to use need language for a nicer car. And then we start to use need language for cars for specific assignments. And then we start to use need language for things that we call show cars, cars with no utility at all. I realize that picking on cars here might be onerous if you're a car lover, and there are some in this community. And I want the people that are car lovers in this community to know that, personally, I have some sympathy for beauty. And that there is an aspect of this love affair of our culture with the car that is about that. I'm not picking on that part. What I want this all to point to is to a way of thinking, which is about stuff. Which is that acquiring stuff for its own sake, or for the sake of status, or because the person next to us has one that's newer, shinier, or faster, or does more tricks, or comes with more cool apps. Now it's personal. The point is that this kind of an approach to stuff suggests that rather than placing too high a value on stuff, we might actually be placing too low a value on stuff. And by stuff, I mean physical things. I believe that physical things matter, that matter matters, that the matter that we are as embodied beings matters, that the matter that we're entrusted with as caregivers for the stuff of the earth matters. And all of that, for me at least, kind of carries us back to the big story where we left off before Lent. We've been looking at those first chapters of Genesis that really plunge us into the story of creation, and we're sort of at the point where we were dealing with the fact that there are two creation narratives in the book of Genesis. And the second creation story ends with this telling little sentence that the man and his wife were naked and they felt no shame. The idea behind naked and felt no shame is the idea of what I would call primal goodness. It's the idea that God made us beautiful in our embodied realities, and that because of that goodness, there is nothing to be ashamed of. Now, there's ways in which this is easily seen to be true and ways in which it becomes very complicated and conflicted. I remember, I think it was Kale, one of our kids, as a little guy, climbing up on the bathroom counter, wrapped in his towel after his bath, and kind of whipping his towel off in front of the mirror and going, "This mirror is going to show me my naked." This was just, it was just like triumph, you know. This is going to be awesome. There's a kind of acceptance and even celebration of the embodied self that kind of goes away as we get older, it seems. Gets lost. Actually, saying that it gets lost might be a bit of an understatement, wouldn't it? It's more like it gets obliterated. It's more like it gets swept out to sea on a tsunami of advertising that's designed to create not just dissatisfaction with our embodied self, but shame about it. And that creates, in our culture, a very weird and troubling dynamic where we spend millions of dollars a year as a culture trying to make some parts of our bodies smaller and other parts of our bodies bigger, and if we can't pull it off at the gym, then we get more invasive about it. I realize, I feel acutely aware in some ways that plastic surgery can be a tremendous gift in many situations, but those situations are not the particular ones I'm talking about. I'm thinking more about this strange trajectory of consumption that is driven by shame that leads us to spend billions of dollars as a culture trying to moderate the impact of our own excesses, while on the other side of the ocean or the other side of the city or the other side of the block, there are people that are starving or eating food that make them systematically not well because they can't afford what they truly need. That's a strange piece of economics. And so to bring that back into the context of this big story, the core issue, as that pithy little sentence defines it for us, is shame. And it's intriguing to me that so early in this story, we have a picture of a desirable way of living that is outlined for us with this little sentence about being naked and unashamed. It's intriguing to me how integrated the world of that creation narrative is. This is a story, and this is the seminal story. This is the beginning story for us in our faith. It's a story that is pretty thoroughly without dualism. It's pretty thoroughly without the kind of view of the world that says it's legitimate to divide the world into parts. We're going to call one part spiritual, we're going to call the other part material, we're going to say the spiritual part's good, we're going to say the material part's bad or evil. From the beginning of the narrative, that if we walk in the way of Christ, from the beginning of the narrative from which springs that story, all that God makes is at its very worst good. All parts of the world around us are portrayed as either good or very good. A wonderful poet, writer named Michael Guyte, British guy. Guyte says of poetic language and poetic imagination that the inexactitude, what a great word, the inexactitude of poetics describes life better than language of precision. I just think that is so absolutely true and reflective of the genius of this story. The fact that we have two different creation narratives, for instance, is just an egregious example of working inexactitude. So how did it happen? Like story one or story two? Well, that's not the point, is it? From the beginning, the inexactitude of this story is embracing. It's enormous. And it says that all that God has made is either good or very good. To me, that dynamic in the Genesis story becomes especially interesting when we find out that the Genesis stories themselves are in many ways recycled. It's a time when the Jewish people were coming to be a people, when they were coming into existence as a nation. When this was happening historically, the Jewish people were surrounded by other ancient cultures and ancient peoples. And those other ancient cultures had their own creation accounts. They had their own stories. And the folks that study these things more deeply than I ever will have noted how some of those key stories were taken up by the Jewish people and they were recycled. They were given new life as the accounts that now comprise our own sacred text. And I'm not going to try to be exhaustive about this. It's a huge field of study. There's lots there to consider and wrestle with. But I think it's worth noting a couple of the stories, largely because their recycled shape is so very distinct or different from their original shape. They're obviously connected, and yet they've been recycled in the Jewish history in ways that are lovely and good, even very good. One of the cultures that was really influential on the Jewish people was the culture of the Sumerians. The Sumerians occupied what would now be modern-day Iraq. They are one of the earliest and most powerful of the ancient civilizations, of the ancient defined cultures. And one of their creation stories has this character called Tiamat. Tiamat was kind of like a primal crocodile. He was like an ultimate monster. And we've touched on this before, but it's worth being reminded that in our ancient creation story, rather than in the beginning there is a primal monster, what we have is in the beginning God. In the Sumerian story, it's in the beginning a monster, in the beginning a force of chaos and a force of danger. And what happens in that story is that there's some other gods, wherever they all come from in the story, and they take on Tiamat in battle. They split him in two, and one part of Tiamat becomes the sky, and one part becomes the earth. And so right from the beginning of that culture's story of how the world is, we have a narrative of violence and bloodshed. We have a narrative of the necessity of something needing to be destroyed so something else can be produced. Tiamat has to be torn asunder for there to be earth and sky. And that's the shape of the universe. But when the Jewish people get a hold of this story, they give it this lovely twist. And so in the Jewish creation narrative, instead of violence being at the core of the universe, God is at the core of the universe. And as the story unfolds, we discover that the character and nature of the God that's at the core of the universe is that this is a being that creates. And this is a being that rests. And this is a being that shares the work of creation with others. That invites co-creators into the story very early on. That is a very different kind of universe to live in than the universe with a Tiamat legend at the core. The Egyptians were also a very significant people group at this point in the history of the Jews. I don't have time to get deep into that context, but there's profound links between the culture of Egypt and the culture that we live in today. A bit of a convoluted journey, but the links are clear enough. At any rate, the Egyptians also had a creation story. And the god at the center of that story had a couple different names. Khepri or Atum is the one that has survived a little better. Atum rises out of the primal waters at the beginning of time in the Egyptian creation story. And Atum is a he-she god, a two-gendered god, is characterized as having only one eye. And Atum somehow in the story has children, and the children run away. And Atum sends his or her eye out to look for the children. And that eye becomes the sun. There's something kind of nice about this story, in the sense that for an Egyptian, growing up with this view of the universe, to look at the sun was to look at the eye of God looking for the lost children and trying to bring them home. Recognize anything there? Here's the interesting thing that's an extension of that. In the Egyptian creation narratives, creation is all done before God introduces humans into the story. I mean, really all done. The irrigation ditches are dug and working. The cities are in place. In our culture, you know, we would say coffee's on. Like it's like a set. Everything is there in those narratives. And then the humans are brought into the story. This is important because the reason that the Egyptian god in this story makes humans and brings them into the story is to keep the apparatus going. That's why humans are brought into the narrative by God in this creation story. What does that produce? Well, one of the things that it produces is fantastic infrastructure. Because humans, in that view of the universe, are the drones of the gods. It's not coincidental, people, that in this Egyptian view of the universe, the rulers of the Egyptians understood and characterized themselves to be divine. They were gods. What does that make the rest of the humans? Right. It makes them drones. You don't build things like the pyramids without this kind of a view of the universe. Because the people go, no, we're not going to do it. Mm-hmm. You have to have a view of the universe that says the ruler is divine and the people are meant to be. We are placed here by God to be slaves. I'm not taking up space here because I have nothing else to say this morning. The view that we have of the universe, the story we have that shapes our understanding of the divine and the nature of the world that we live in has this kind of an impact on the human experience of life. To have a creation narrative that says the reason you exist as a human person is to serve God, and then to have a human ruler say, and by the way, I'm a God, produces a world of enslavement. The trickle down, among other trickle downs, is our own Western history of what history calls the divine right of kings. We might not have found it tenable to regard kings as divinities, but there was an awful big chunk of Western history where we found it tenable to live as though the king's claim to be placed by God and to speak with God's authority was believable and should be responded to at that level. It's a huge part of our story in the Western world. It's a huge part of the story of Christendom. Maybe it's a misappropriation of something, because the Genesis story is so different from this very significant, to the Jewish people, very significant and impacting Egyptian story. When the Jewish people get a hold of this story about God making the world and forming it and placing humans in it, what's so profoundly different is that the humans are not in the Genesis story to be slaves to the status quo, but they are created right from the beginning to work with creation, to develop it, to bring out its potential, to nurture it, to garden it, to impact it. That's completely different than the story that the Jewish people started with and then recycled. We are not just here in that story to be the dumb servants of creation. We are not in this story to be the drones of the gods. What happens when you take a story that is not predicated on primal violence, it's not set up to promote the status quo, it's not set up to keep those holding the power continuing to hold it and wield it through vertical authority and abuse, it's not set up to support systematic oppression, and you bring it into lived life? What happens when you work and live from a story in which the root is not primal violence, but primal harmony? What happens when you try to live out of a story in which all the parts of the universe work together, which is meant to set in motion a world in which humans can live without fear and danger, in which we are full participants in what's being made, we're beings without shame, we're beings with the dignity of being made in the image of a nonviolent, cooperative, deeply creative God? What happens when you try to live out of a narrative like that? One way to probe that question is to look at what I would call unrecycled stories that are pretty much still fully in play in our culture. Stories in which bloody competition for being at the top of the heap at the end of the fray frames the most important kinds of decisions. It's interesting to me how that kind of a point of view that sees what's problematic about that storyline, is usually the most visible to people groups that themselves have been systematically oppressed. That's who tends to see this in the story. Power holders don't tend to see the story this way. It's understandable, isn't it? Before Trevor headed home for the summer, he paid me a visit, and he left me a rather large box of books, like a couple feet square large. There's a lot of books in there. Trevor's a big guy, and he was asking for help carrying it in from the car. And I have my permission to read whatever books from that box I want, which is lovely of Trev. But he did take the liberty of leaving the one that he thought was most compelling right on top. And that book was this one, Cornel West, Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Cornel West. As Canadians, we probably know Cornel West best if we were paying attention to the credits at the end of the movie for appearing as Counselor West in the second and third Matrix films. But he is, among other things, a philosopher, an author, a critic, an academic, a civil rights activist. He's a man of African-American descent, currently a prof at Princeton, but he's moving this year to a Union Theological Seminary, which is interesting. He opens this particular book with a pair of quotes. One's from James Baldwin. He's a late American novelist, an essayist, a playwright, again an African-American person, a social critic. Somebody from a people group that I think it's fair to describe as systematically oppressed. And Baldwin writes this in the introduction to West's book. He says, to be an Afro-American or an American black is to be in a situation intolerably exaggerated of all those who have ever found themselves part of a civilization which they could in no wise honorably defend. Yet, they were compelled, indeed endlessly, to attack and condemn, and who yet spoke out of the most passionate love, hoping to make the kingdom new, to make it honorable and worthy of life. In West's opening critique of American democracy, which is what this particular book is about, he kind of fires this salvo across the bow of what he calls free market fundamentalism. Very interesting language. And I'm just going to read you a little bit of this. Free market fundamentalism, just as dangerous as the religious fundamentalism of our day, trivializes the concern for public interest. The overwhelming power and influence of plutocrats and oligarchs in the economy put fear and insecurity in the hearts of anxiety-ridden workers and render money-driven, poll-obsessed elected officials deferential to corporate goals of profit, often at the cost of the common good. This illicit marriage of corporate and political elites, so blatant and flagrant in our time, not only undermines the trust of informed citizens in those who rule over them, it also promotes the pervasive sleepwalking of the populace, who see that the false prophets are handsomely rewarded with money, status, and access to more power. This profit-driven vision is sucking the democratic life out of American society. In short, the dangerous dogma of free market fundamentalism turns our attention away from schools to prisons, from workers' conditions to profit margins, from health clinics to high-tech facial surgeries, from civic associations to pornographic internet sites, and from children's care to strip clubs. The fundamentalism of the market puts a premium on the activities of buying and selling, consuming and taking, promoting and advertising, and develops community, compassionate charity, and improvement of the general, devalues community, compassionate charity, and the improvement of the general quality of life. How ironic that in America we've moved so quickly from Martin Luther King Jr.'s "Let freedom ring" to "bling bling," as if freedom were reducible to simply having material toys, as dictated by free market fundamentalism. I mean, you can hear what he's up to in terms of evocative rhetoric. And that's not insignificant. Here's part of what comes out of this for me. I mean, we can easily dismiss someone like West by saying, well, A, we're not American. B, we're not Afro-American. And C, we're Christians and Christians are nice. I don't know what C should be. Maybe that's it. I find it really interesting that West is both an aggressive and intelligent voice in the public debate and somebody who is unapologetically and outspokenly Christian. It comes through in his language. In this particular bit that I just read, the language of false prophets, for instance. It comes through in James Baldwin's language about making the kingdom new. And I find it challenging and heartening to hear someone like West do what the ancient biblical Jewish story does, the story that we live out of if we live as followers of Christ. And that what he does with it is he takes the story of the culture and he just stands it on its ear. He recycles it. And he says, there's a different way to read this. There's a different way to imagine this. Our Western ideals, the ideals that we live and work with every day, are visibly rooted in a reading of the biblical narrative that often seems to me to have more kinship to the primal stories of violence than it does to the recycled versions that actually made it into print in the Bible. West, I won't take the time to read the section I was going to, but he goes on to talk about aggressive militarism. And he talks about us using the rationale of aggressive militarism to promote what he calls adventuresome crusades. The rhetoric of sending people off to war as though it were, first of all, a legitimate crusade, and secondly, a grand adventure. And I read them on this stuff, and there's something inside of me that just goes, ding, ding, ding. Anybody read their history? Anybody recognize this language? Anybody remember the Crusades? When we gather here, you guys, I warned you about the political nature of this, right? When we gather this morning, we gather under the banner of Christianity, of Christendom. We might have all kinds of mixed feelings about that. But the fact remains that that is the banner under which we gather to do this kind of thinking. And from which we go to try to discern how we will live. History provides us with all kinds of examples of what happens when we stop reconsidering, when we stop recycling core stories. It's not hard to see what happens to political life and power if you're working from a narrative that says that God is fundamentally judgmental and violent. You don't have to go as far back in history as the Crusades to see how this plays out. All you have to do is pay attention to Bush's language when he called the invasion of Iraq a crusade, and then his advisors got a hold of his speech the next day and said, "Don't say that word anymore," and he changed his language. It's that close to home. The story we imagine to be the core story of our belief deeply shapes the way we work in the world, and that's why we need to pay attention to the recycling of the core story, as the Jewish people did it, and as we have it to work with. It's challenging. I'm not saying this is easy or simple. It's easy to be a critic, and I've done plenty of that this morning. Again, the point is to provoke, to be catalytic, not to have the last word. If you actively disagree with something I've said this morning, then I feel like I've actually done my job, because it means you're thinking about what we're talking about. And that's the point. The ways in which we behave, if the core of our story is one of primal violence, will reflect that core story. The ways in which we behave, if we believe the center of the oldest version of this story is that God makes things that are material, that are matter, that are made of stuff, that is good and very good, including the stuff of us, impacts the way we believe and behave. And among the other things that can change is the way we read the whole rest of the story and even the everyday kind of nuts and boltsy things like why we would bother to recycle our trash. Happy Earth Day. Amen.